It is Monday, October the 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, the latest on the mass shooting at a U.S. synagogue. Jair Bolsonaro is Brazil's president-elect.
Without question, this was far more a vote against the Brazilian political establishment than a vote for Jair Bolsonaro.
Central American migrants heading to the U.S., plus the plight of millions of refugees.
My impression is that we don't have a good refugee system. The system itself is kind of broken.
Also ahead, the New York Marathon and the Hudson Miracle Connection, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The suspect in Saturday's attack on a synagogue in the U.S. city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that left 11 dead is being treated this hour for his own injuries after exchanging gunfire with police. AP's Ben Thomas is following the story.
U.S. Attorney Scott Brady says Robert Bowers entered the Tree of Life Synagogue in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood of Pittsburgh Saturday with multiple weapons.
He had three Glock, 357 handguns, and an AR-15 assault rifle.
A law enforcement official says Bowers had a license to carry firearms and legally owned his guns.
We got a guy barricaded actively shooting at SWAT operatives.
A tactical team located the 46-year-old on the third floor, where he shot two officers multiple times, as reported here in police dispatch communications from Broadcastify.com. Among the charges Bowers faces, 29 federal counts that include hate crimes, charges that could lead to the death penalty. I'm Ben Thomas.
And for some perspective on all of this, we spoke with Brian Levin. He is the director of the Center for Hate and Extremism at California State University at San Bernardino. We asked him if he would concur what happened in Pittsburgh was a profound event.
Yes, and our center was among the first to categorize it, at least certainly in recent American history. Yes, this is a domestic terror attack, and it's emblematic of a rising tide of extremism of which far right wing is most ascendant, most fragmented, and also one that is reliant on loners and small cells.
We also asked if hate crimes from the social and political left are as prevalent as hate crimes from the right.
Interestingly, in 2016, we had double-digit percentage increases against Latinos, against Arabs, Muslims, transgender, but also white. And just in the past couple of weeks, we saw a firebombing of a truck with a Trump bumper sticker. We've also seen Antifa get into altercations with far-right wing folks. However, the data is very consistent on this in recent years. Unlike the 70s, where we had both Puerto Rican and black nationalist groups, as well as anti-war groups and Marxist groups and groups like the Symbionese Liberation Army, and we had a slew of bombings. Now, most of the incidents, though not all, most of the incidents are right-wing. And what we have found is there is a rising tide. We have among the most diversified threat matrix that we've had in decades. But I would say that the far right is the most ascendant. You certainly can't count out violent Salafist jihadists. They are splintered, but ISIS's decline, Daesh's decline, and their lack of access to social media relative to years past has hit them hard. And again, the left wing has not been attracting people because folks are invested in the coming election and violence is not appealing as much as through traditional measures. At least you haven't seen this wellspring on the left. That being said, there is a socio-political coalescence on the hard left of some who approve of violence.
Brian Levin is the director of the Center for Hate and Extremism at California State University at San Bernardino. He's also professor of criminal justice. Also in the news, Brazilian right-wing president-elect Jair Bolsonaro has stirred controversy with comments in the past about women, blacks, gays, indigenous people, with some analysts saying all of this is polarizing. Sunday, he won Brazil's election with nearly all the ballots counted. Bolsonaro of the Social Liberal Party won about 55% of the votes, while his left-leaning opponent, Fernando Haddad, of the Workers' Party, took 45%. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Mark Jones, a fellow in political science at the Baker Institute, the Joseph D. Jamail Chair in Latin American Studies, and a professor in the Department of Political Science at Rice University. He was asked if Bolsonaro's rise was the result of people voting for something or against something.
Without question, this was far more a vote against the Brazilian political establishment than a vote for Jair Bolsonaro. And it's also important to place into the context where people were given effectively two suboptimal choices. That is, Fernando Haddad, who is seen as too far to the left, too linked to Lula da Silva, and too linked to the corrupt establishment, and Jair Bolsonaro, who was linked essentially to a host of statements in the past that were homophobic, misogynistic, racist, and is really someone that people are uncertain about what he's going to do once in office.
What's the concern about human rights under a Bolsonaro administration?
There's widespread fear across the world that under Jair Bolsonaro, we'll see a severe erosion in political rights and civil liberties in Brazil, and the country transit towards a more authoritarian form of government, like we've seen in places such as Turkey, Russia, and Venezuela.
The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court did an unexpected and extraordinary thing. He read out part of the Constitution to reporters after he voted. He said the future president must respect institutions, democracy, rule of law, judiciary branch, national Congress, and legislative branch. Is there a concern that he'll return Brazil to a military dictatorship?
I don't think there's a belief that he's going to return to a military-controlled government, but there is a fear that he's going to effectively concentrate power in the executive branch and begin to not respect all of Brazil's constitution. Recall that while the Brazilian Supreme Court justice did read out the Brazilian constitution, Venezuela, Russia, and Turkey all had very fine democratic constitutions that strongmen such as President Erdogan, President Putin, and President Chavez effectively ignored.
Mr. Bolsonaro, Mark, was elected despite the political establishment in Brazil urging voters to vote against him.
Some of the political establishment on the center, left, and left urged for a vote against Bolsonaro, but many of the more traditional right-wing parties and center-right parties, such as the PSDB, the MDB, and the Dems, effectively stayed out of it, signaling to their voters that it was okay to vote for Bolsonaro.
He faces a host of domestic problems, including corruption, crime, and recession.
Without question, the country that he's going to inherit is one that's in dire straits. The economy has been struggling, the political establishment is viewed as corrupt, and there's severe public insecurity with crime rampant throughout urban areas, but also in more rural areas. It's only on the latter area where we have a firm understanding of what Jair Bolsonaro is going to do, and that is he's going to crack down hard on crime, utilizing the military and the federal police far more aggressively, and promoting a far more severe sanctions against criminals. And I would expect things are going to get very tough for many of the drug gangs that control many of Brazil's favelas. They're a form of shantytown.
Brazil, of course, the largest Latin American country, has the largest economy. What impact will his election have on the region?
For the region, it's likely to create uncertainty in the sense that many investors are going to hold off investment, and that's going to cool down the Brazilian economy, which is very bad news for countries such as Argentina and Uruguay and Paraguay that do a great bit of trade with Brazil. Argentina in particular is in pretty desperate economic straits, and it needs more than ever for Brazil's economy to start booming again because it's one of the principal destinations for Argentine manufactured exports. But for now, I think we're likely looking at least in the short term uncertainty related to Brazil, and things actually could get much worse because one thing that President Bolsonaro will not have is much in the way of support in Congress. His party has less than one out of every 10 seats in the Brazilian Chamber of Deputies and even fewer in the Brazilian Senate. And so he's going to need to form strong multi-party coalitions to get anything done. There's a fear that the tendency will thus be faced with a Congress that's very unmanageable to resort to executive decrees and effectively bypass the Congress, albeit in a quasi-constitutional manner.
Mark, is this good news or bad news for the United States?
For the United States, this is probably bad news in the sense that this creates uncertainty and instability in Brazil. And up until the most recent crisis in Brazil, we in the United States had effectively delegated control of the South America, or at least sort of being the regional sheriff in South America, to Brazil. So the United States has not been actively involved in countries like Venezuela, even though they're experiencing severe crises. The fact that Jair Bolsonaro is now in office in Brazil means that the United States will not be able to count on Brazil to effectively engage in regional activities, and it'll be far more internally focused on its own problems, which could lead to a vacuum of power in the region that other countries could fill, such as China.
Mark Jones is a fellow in political science at the Baker Institute, the Joseph D. Jamail Chair in Latin American Studies, and a professor in the Department of Political Science at Rice University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. UN Refugee Agency is urging Washington to allow people fleeing persecution and violence, including those who are traveling with the Central American caravan, to request asylum on U.S. territory. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
U.S. President Donald Trump has vowed to prevent a caravan of thousands of immigrants from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador from entering the United States. He is sending 800 troops to safeguard the southwest border of the country. The UN Refugee Agency will not weigh in on whether it is legal for a country to close its borders to refugees and asylum seekers. But it says international law clearly states any person whose life may be in danger has the right to seek asylum and benefit from international protection. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic tells VOA his agency has alerted countries along the caravan's route that it is likely to include people in real danger.
Our position globally is that the individuals who are fleeing persecution and violence need to be given access to territory and protection, including refugee status determination procedure. And if the people who are fleeing persecution and violence enter Mexico, they need to be provided access to the Mexican asylum system, and those entering the United States need to be provided access to the American asylum system.
Mahecic says the UNHCR is very concerned about the developing humanitarian situation along the migratory route. He says there are kidnapping and security risks in the areas where the caravan may be venturing. He says that it is urgent to stabilize the situation, to provide proper reception, and to improve basic conditions for people on the move. In regard to people seeking asylum, he says their international protection needs must be properly assessed before any decision is taken on their return or deportation. The Mexican Ministry of the Interior reports more than 1,740 asylum claims have been registered in Tapachula in the state of Chiapas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We've been hearing a lot lately about refugees and migrants coming into the United States and other countries. Nowhere appears to be offering a particularly welcoming environment, but it comes at a time when there are huge and growing numbers of migrants and refugees around the world. VOA's Lori London got reaction and some analysis from James Raymer. He is a professor in the Australian National University School of Demography.
My impression is that we don't have a good refugee system. The system itself is kind of broken.
Do you mean we? What do you mean we? Do you mean
the global community?
Okay.
So I think most people in countries would support helping people in need.
Mm-hmm.
People don't want people to suffer or to die or to be thrown in jail unfairly. People want to help other people, but they want there to be a fair system underlying that. And what we have is we don't have a really good processing system.
Why do you think that the world seems to have shifted so dramatically to be so seemingly unwelcome to people from other places?
Well, I think what's really hurt the whole refugee process is that, I think this happened in the 1990s, where people used the refugee system, people who weren't refugees used the refugee system to migrate. And so you had countries, a lot of countries would have, they would process 100 people who have claimed asylum, and only, say, 10% would be considered refugees. Mm-hmm. But each those 100 people that they processed would be there in the country for a year. They'd be kind of in a holding state, and they'd have to prove. So it's a real tedious individual legal process that each country who signs on to the United Nations Conventions mm-hmm. has to go through to ensure that a person is a refugee. It's a legal entitlement. And because the law is so specific, you've got people coming from countries in, say, Africa who maybe they're not in fear of persecution or death, but they otherwise have no life. I mean, their life chances are pretty dismal. A really poor environment. They've got corrupt political systems. And they're just escaping, trying to live a better life for them and their family. But technically, they're not refugees.
What do you think about the current administration in the White House in Washington in America and the policies about, you know, immigration, which seem so dramatically different than we've really seen before?
Well, I don't think it's helpful. It's certainly not solving the problem, you know, to close yourself off, to blame migrants or blame refugees for problems that they're not responsible for is wrong. I think we need to be thinking about more about coordinated systems. I do agree with Australia. You want to cut down smuggling routes and make sure that mm-hmm. migrants have safe passage. But also, there's a big problem in that people who sometimes have no other alternative but to hire a smuggler.
We've got a lot of war-torn regions now. Do we even have a current number of refugees in the world right now?
Well, you have to make a distinction between refugees and asylum seekers, right? Refugees, mm-hmm. you would know because they've been granted asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we don't have any refugees, but we don't know the number of people who need support. It'll be much greater than any statistics because some people won't even have the means to flee,
mm-hmm.
so they'll be trapped. Usually the people who are able to get across borders are the ones that are more well-off. The ones who are often persecuted, they may not even have the means to escape.
James Raymer is a professor in the Australian National University School of Demography, and he was speaking with VOA's Laurie London. The pilot who miraculously landed his plane on the Hudson River in New York in 2009, saving everyone on board, and the air traffic controller who helped him get there safely will meet again. That'll happen at the New York City Marathon. We get more now from AP's Julie Walker.
Do you want to try to land 1913?
We're unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
Pilot Chesley Sully Sullenberger and air traffic controller Pat Harton are forever linked by the amazing water landing that saved all 155 on board after a double bird strike damaged both engines in January of 2009. Now Sully Sullenberger will be at the finish line of the New York City Marathon on November 4th to give Harton his medal as he completes the race. Harton is a second-generation air traffic controller following the path of his father, who also introduced him to marathons. Harton's done 4 marathons, but this will be his first one in New York City. I'm Julie Walker.
And still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Phantom limb pain is described as ongoing painful sensations that seem to be coming from a limb that is no longer there. An amputee advocacy group says that it's thought that nearly 80% of those who have had limbs amputated have experienced this kind of pain. A recent study proposes a new theory for how this mysterious condition may originate. The research is from Max Ortiz Catalan from the Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden. He suggests that after amputation, the nervous system circuitry linked to the prior limb no longer has a job to do. It then can become entangled with another neural network, such as the one responsible for pain perception. Catalan's new theory builds on his work in developing an artificial intelligence-based treatment that addresses phantom limb pain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It's time now for a little something from the world of music.
If you don't know me,
Old Melvin and the Blue Notes were an American vocal group, one of the most popular in the 1970s. The repertoire included soul, R&B, doo-wop, and disco.
Like I understand you. Now, baby, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to upset our happy home. Oh, don't get so excited when I come home a little late at night, 'cause we only act like children when we argue for some fun.
Don't Know Me By Now was a big hit for Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Another super successful song for the group was Bad Luck from their album To Be True, featuring Teddy Pendergrass, the group's lead singer during many of their successful years. Formerly known as the Charlemagnes, took on the name the Blue Notes in 1954 with a lineup consisting of lead singer Franklin Peeker, Bernard Williams, Roosevelt Brody, Jesse Gillis Jr., and Harold Melvin. The group's lineup changed frequently over the years, but fan favorites were always on their concert playlist. Don't Leave Me This Way is one of those hit songs.
Survive, can't stay alive without your love. Don't leave me this way, no. I can't exist, I'll surely miss your tender kiss. Don't leave me this way, no. Don't leave me this way. A broken man with empty hands. Baby, please, please don't leave me this way.
Oh, baby,
my heart is full of love and desire for you.
Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes hits have been re-recorded by many artists, including David Ruffin, Simply Red, Jimmy Somerville, Sybil, and John Legend. Others, such as Kanye West and Jay-Z, have sampled the Blue Notes music. Several members of various incarnations of the Blue Notes continue to tour as Harold Melvin's Blue Notes. Melvin's widow, Avelia, currently manages the group.
Away, I can't survive, can't stay alive without your love. Don't leave me this way.
I remember seeing them when I was in college. That was about 345 years ago. It's amazing. Great music. Love them. On the radio all the time. Still today, you can hear Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Hey, listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America. We're good to have you here with International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman. We're all here in Washington hoping you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes.
I need it right now. Say I need it. I need your loving, baby. See, your love, well, your love is so important, important to me. Oh, baby.
This is Today in History.
On October 29, 1682, William Penn arrived in the British American colony that bore his name, Pennsylvania. On this day in 1858, the first store opened in the small town that would later become Denver, Colorado. The store served miners flocking to strike it rich during the area's gold rush. The 29th of October was called Black Tuesday in 1929. It was the day of the great crash, the frenzied, panic-fueled trading of stocks as investors struggled desperately to avoid financial ruin. When the dust settled, nearly 12% of the market's value had been wiped out, contributing to the nation's descent into the Great Depression. On this day in 1956, Israeli armed forces pushed into Egypt toward the Suez Canal. The attack followed a decision by Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser to nationalize the canal. Britain and France sided with the Israelis, but were forced to back down due to opposition from the United States and the Soviet Union. On this day in 1923, Turkey formally became a republic after the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire. Mustafa Kemal, later known as Ataturk, or Father of the Turks, led the founding of the republic. In 1960, young Cassius Clay, who later took the name Muhammad Ali, won his first professional fight in Louisville, Kentucky. In 2004, European leaders signed the European Union's first constitution. In 2008, Delta Airlines merged with Northwest Airlines, creating the world's largest airline and reducing the number of U.S. legacy carriers to five. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.